Hi everyone, you're tuned in for another episode of Getting to the Root of It with Venus Roots, aka me, your host. And today's guest is Vincent Bevins, acclaimed journalist and author of the books The Jakarta Method and If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and The Missing Revolution. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so I mean, Vincent, I'll say I think your book is like ambitious in a lot of ways because it sort of traverses through really distinct corners of the world. So I think because of that, there's like so many different threads that we can pull at and unravel. But I'm especially interested right now in having this conversation with you because, you know, we're in a really particular historical conjuncture right now around mass protests, specifically millions of people protesting the genocide happening in Gaza right now. And that those protests have been happening all over the world. And I think so many people are wondering, like, how much longer will we need to be in the streets for the horrors of Zionist occupation to end? But before we get into all that, I kind of want to like situate and ground people who maybe read your newest book, If We Burn, and also those who maybe haven't. And I think one of the main questions your book is thinking about is the reality that, yes, in the last decade, like 2010 to 2020, it's been mass demonstrations, mass protests all over the world. But you also sort of outline how like this alone doesn't translate to more progressive political conditions. Mm-hmm. And in how a lot of times it actually results in more reactionary, more fascist conditions and kind of like the opposite of what people were out on the streets protesting and asking for. So, you know, you look at like a dozen countries, all with their own particular contexts and nuances. But I'm curious kind of like what sort of sparked your curiosity in thinking about this contradiction.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much for that. I think that's like very, very much the ground on which all of this is built, the way you've just described that. But personally, and my connection to this topic was indeed personal. I got interested in this kind of thing. The question of what happened in the 2010s, how were there so many mass protests? How was it that so many people came together to demand a better world or demand political changes? And then what happened afterwards? I arrived in the middle of that story, or that sort of story came knocking on my, or sort of on the window of my apartment building a little over 10 years ago in Sao Paulo. I was working as a correspondent in Brazil. I've been covering the ups and downs of politics in that country for a few years. And then we had a mass protest explosion that was started initially by leftists and anarchists that got very, very, very big, very, very quickly. It was quickly read by foreign media, including people like me, to some extent me, myself, as if it were the same kind of thing as had already been happening starting back in 2010 and 2011 with Tunisia and Egypt and the rest of what became to be called the Arab Spring. And then Turkey, which was happening at the exact same time, and then Ukraine, which happened right afterwards. And so I lived very intimately this arrival of a small protest carried out by people who I didn't know directly, but I knew people who knew them. They were sort of in my broader social circle. I knew what they were about and what they wanted to achieve, and I found it all quite sympathetic. And then when there was this huge explosion of people onto the streets, I, like many other people, on like the broad in like the, in the broadest sense, progressive wings of society, experienced that explosion as like a euphoric break. Like this is it's happening. That it you know like not to think of like not exactly you know the revolution is here, but like. Look at what these kids put together and look at the whole country coming together behind it. And I believed deep in my soul, like, of course that can, that's, that gets good. Well, what happened over the next few weeks complicated that narrative very deeply. And then what happened over the next few years was like blow after blow after blow to the head of the left in Brazil. And all of it, you could say somehow or another arising from that explosion itself back in 2013. So it's like, it wasn't just that I was a journalist that, you know, this was a big story for me, but like a lot of my closest friends and people that I interacted with on a daily basis, like had their lives like really, really, really worsened by what came next in Brazil, which was a reactionary backlash, a group of people that very cynically took advantage of what had been happening on the streets, people that hijacked and redirected and lied about what it was that was initially happening, and then ultimately helped to put in power the most extreme right leader, I think, in the democratic world, Jair Bolsonaro, who was elected in 2018. So all of that was, as I said, personal. And so throughout the rest of the decade, when other stuff like this happened, I'm not the only one. A lot of Brazilians or people who lived through what happened in Brazil, when they saw something unfolding in another country that seemed to be similar, we watched very carefully, sort of hoping that it wouldn't go the same way, afraid that it might. And it didn't always, but this is how I got involved in it. And so then, you know, because of what I had done in my first book and what I enjoyed doing and I thought sort of worked, was to build a global history around one particular national narrative and around one particular phenomenon. In the first book, The Jakarta Method, that the national narrative is Indonesia in the years after World War II and into the Cold War, and the phenomenon is the intentional mass murder of leftists. What I tried to do this time is something sort of, as you say, harder to do and perhaps more ambitious, because it's near history. There's still things we don't really understand, and certainly the answers as to what to do about it are not yet, I don't think, exist yet. But what I tried to do is to build a global history around, again, one national narrative. So the Brazilian story is the main one, and then around one very specific phenomenon, the mass protest that got so big that it became something else. The mass protest that got so big that it either overthrew a government or fundamentally destabilized an existing government. And then what happened next? And as you say, sometimes this was pretty good, and a lot of times it really was not. And so that's how I came to it personally. And I absolutely take the point about the importance of the connection to the moment right now. Like, I have not only been paying close attention to, but participating in, and to the extent that I can, supporting the protests in support of Palestine. And so there are ways in which it is related, the ways which it is not. But yeah, that's my best attempt to answer your two first questions.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. I really appreciate how, you know, I think you do it really well in both books, and both Jakarta Method and If We Burn, of just like, yeah, you kind of like end up being a character in these stories of you know, major historical, I don't know, waves, right? And it gives you a really unique perspective and access to certain relationships and stories, and from like a really intimate perspective. So I think, you know, you're bringing up or something that comes to mind when I'm hearing you is, I think, like a question of maybe governance. You know, there's many instances, you know, that you talk about in the book where, yeah, a reactionary, a right wing, like neo-fascist government is actually the sort of outcome, or maybe we can say just what happens in response to these mass protests, right? And I think even right now, right, to connect it to this moment, like, we're seeing the heightened repression very clearly. And, you know, I live in New York, and since October 7th, there's been, it's so palpable, right? The police presence, the National Guard being in every subway station, like all of these things are in response to these mass protests happening in the city. So I kind of wanted to put a question for you around like questions of governance for the left in the cases where, you know, and these are broad questions, but in the cases where the right is able to actually sort of wield power, or even the moments where the left or more progressive leadership is able to come in, and then this oftentimes maybe doesn't deliver all of the promises for a number of reasons, right, which I think you know really well. But I'm curious for you, like, how you're thinking of the tension between when there are moments that the left or more progressive leadership may win or may hold some power, but also knowing that like the institutions and anchors of power also uphold and like respond to the demands of global capital and imperialism and all these things, kind of. Yeah, how are you thinking about that tension? Because I think it's, you know, often what we hear is oh, so-and-so sold out, right? Oh, Lula sold out. Oh, he sort of gave himself to the bankers and this and that. And, you know, I'm someone that comes from an organizing background, and I've thought a lot about governance and the particularities of it. And it's not that, you know, it's not that simple or that linear. But yeah, curious, like, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I mean, just to, before I answer the full question, like, a lot more people in Brazil had this idea about the Workers' Party 10 years ago than they do now. Like, quite a lot of people that in 2012 or 2013 might have been like, oh, the Lula and Dilma have made peace with the new, you know, with capital, and we need to put pressure on them from the left. A lot of those people were incredibly relieved when he came back in 2022. Yeah. So that's just, and again, and it's not because the critique of the neoliberalization of the Workers' Party doesn't have some merit to it. Like, even within the left in Brazil, people were saying this about 10 years ago. It's just that they realized very, you know, the very horrible truth, which, you know, emerged not only in Brazil, but in so many countries in the book, that, like, things can get worse no matter what. Things can get much worse than you expected. And then a lot of people were willing to have Lula back. But yeah, you asked about governance, which is, I think, a good way to start, because I think the starting point for this decade is that in 2010, I think basically every human being lived in a state, a government, which is led by a smaller group of people than the population that they're supposed to represent, whether or not that is representation that happens because of elections, representation that happens because of some other set of justifications. And in every single one of these states around the world, there are police, which will, in the final instance, destroy your body if you break the wrong rules in the wrong way. There is a man with a gun or a stick that will beat you to death, if not, you know, or at least close to death. And you have a world capitalist system. Even in the states which are nominally socialist would admit that they exist in a larger world capitalist structure. And there are systems of repression that can be employed against, you know, they're much worse in some places than they are in other places, but in the final instance, they existed almost everywhere. And in the final instance, almost every state exists in a larger capitalist system, somehow has to think a little bit about what capital wants or what capital is doing in their given territory. And then at the same time, I think that the degree to which these governments and states, these states, did represent their people had really weakened. They were less representative of their people than they were supposed to be, less representative of their people than they often used to be in certain parts of the world. This varies again, but I mean, in a lot of like advanced capitalist states, the welfare state has fallen apart, unions have fallen apart. Even like liberal political scientists will quickly admit that the government of the United States responds basically only to capital. The government of the United States, like studies have shown, will respond to pressure from below, but only if a significant section of the ruling class agrees with what is being asked for. So you have a global set of police systems and a real crisis of representation in the global system. And then you have a set of protest tactics that were put together at the end of the 20th century, often by people who had much, much bigger dreams about the state than just to make it better. A lot of the tactics that came together in the beginning of the 2010s had been created by, or at least theorized by, people who really didn't want there to be a state whatsoever. And who saw protest as primarily a way to build different types of power relations on the street rather than to transform the existing set of states. But what happened, and I don't want to blame any of these theorists for not seeing this coming, because nobody really saw it coming. A lot of, you know, and one of the more striking parts about this book, and just like, I don't know if I said this already, but the book is put together through 200, 250 interviews that I did in 12 countries. And what I heard a lot is from even people who had been like fighting and organizing on the ground for a decade to put together a mass protest or to put together a protest. 1 week before, 2 hours before the thing started, they said that they could have never imagined how big it was going to get. But then it gets so big in many cases, and this is selection bias because I chose, this is what I chose to build the book around. In some cases, it got so big that either the existing government fails, like the in the most extreme example, like the dictator gets on a plane and flees the country, right? Or the existing government is like, feels so weakened or feels so much pressure from below that it really wants to give the streets something. It wants to say, okay, what do you want? I know that in order to hold on to my power or to restore order, either in a cold, calculated way, I know that I got to give you something to survive, or, more different types of leaders like Dilma Rousseff in Brazil was probably in this latter camp, thought, okay, well, yeah, you have a point, like, public services should be better in this country. Police brutality is a problem in this country. How can I give the streets what they want? And so you quickly have the question of governance again. Quickly, what you have is either a power vacuum in some countries where there's no government, which is, in some cases was the dream of some of the people that put together these tactics. Although they were always, the people that really believed in that really like exaggerated idea of just like abolish the state and then we will create an entirely different type of society, it was usually a small minority, but somehow a set of tactics and approaches that were put together by those type of people became very popular, or at least there was a sort of an overlap between what was easy to do and what got a lot of people excited about what was happening on the streets. And so then you had a country briefly without a government, or a government that really wanted, that was willing to change. And then often in the cases that, things are most pronounced in the negative turn that they take, someone does actually just start to govern. And then the question of whether or not things got better or worse for you just depends on if that person is somebody that you more or less agreed with, or if it was somebody that was very cynically pretending to represent the streets and just sort of rushing into a power vacuum and setting up a new government system, often just like taking the same police or meeting with the military to create support in the most organized and most dangerous force in any country, which is the armed forces. And then in other cases where you had less pronounced crises, or Brazil again is the main narrative. Dilma like literally can't figure out what to give the streets. She can't figure out what they're asking for. She can't figure out how to come to an agreement, because the people that put together the movement in the first place, at least at the beginning of the movement, they were against the idea of negotiation. They were against the idea of mediation between them and the state. And so you get back to that same question that you said that there, this is something that you said you've seen in New York. Some government, in some cases, you have something goes on for a very, very, very long time. And then even governments that were willing at some point to give something in, they just, they pull out, they open the same old toolbox that every state has, which is repression. They're like, okay, well, I can't figure out how to give these people what they want, so I'm just going to go crush their heads. Which is something that it became clear that you can do, especially, we can get into the individual cases, but especially after what happened to Gaddafi in Libya in 2011, after Hillary Clinton very proudly led a NATO regime change campaign, which resulted in the torture and murder of the leader of that country on YouTube, essentially. A lot of leaders in that region it was a really wild moment, especially to remember the debates of who was in support of that operation and then what happened and then just like how no one talked about what happened afterwards. But a lot of leaders in that region came to the conclusion like, crap, like if that could happen to me, then I'd rather just do whatever evil thing is required to stay in power than to risk being tortured and murdered on the internet. And so that all these elements that we had at the 2010s, including, I think, this kind of rosy image that we had as to what happened with the fall of the Soviet Union, the sort of liberal story that was told about how just people came into the streets and then they overthrew the government, led people to not exactly forget, but to make big enough of a problem for states that in many cases they pulled out that same old tool that all states have always had, which is just to crush people's bodies. And this is, again, something that could have happened, always can happen, but it did happen in many cases in the 2010s. And often when somebody else figures out a way to govern that is very, very different, they often pretended to be doing so in the spirit of the streets, but in taking the country in a very, very different direction.
Yeah, ooh, there's a lot there.
maybe too much time.
No. It's great. I think it's just like my mind's like, oh my God, I have a million questions for you. I mean, you know, something that also comes to mind, because, you know, we're talking about governance and the left and you know, different factions. And you've also written about this pretty extensively. I'm curious, sort of, in all of this, you know, you mentioned the power vacuum, right? And there's always like a contestant, you know, there's always different forces contending for power in all these moments. But curious if you could talk a little bit about sort of the very real impact that just like decades of US backed right-wing coups and the weakening of communist movements and leftist organizations has, that sort of how all of that, you know, that whole recipe is manifesting itself in this contradiction around mass protests not equating to sort of mass transformation.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So, and yeah, so this is something that like is kind of an indirect sequel to my first book, right? Because the first book is sort of the establishment of the US-led capitalist system, like the tactics that are employed to create a global order led by the United States that allows for the reproduction of conditions for the required for the accumulation of capital, and basically, which allows essentially for the most powerful country in the world access to the cheap labor and resources of the peoples of the global South. And this consisted a lot of the decimation of left-wing organizations, of the either crippling starvation or outright mass murder of, and I mean starvation metaphorically, but I mean mass murder literally, of a lot of the movements that in the 20th century would have been seen as the obvious vehicles for carrying out left-wing change, whether those are unions or political parties or social movements or even like armed guerrilla movements. You know, we know how the Cold War ended, the US won, but what is often forgotten is that a lot of that victory contained within it the brutal decimation of left-wing organizations. Now, in some of the protests of the 2010s, there were some people that thought organizations are bad, or at least organizations that have any kind of hierarchy, or organizations that allow for any mediation between, you know, that allow to get in the way of the direct, unmediated interactions between human beings are bad. There was often some people in the 2010s that really believed organizations are bad. And sometimes this can be called horizontalism. Sometimes this was expressed in other ways in the 2010s, but there were some people that believed that. But I think more importantly, and in the broader sense, in many of the countries that we're looking at, all of the organizations that would have been there in a, you know, let's say previous historical epoch had been destroyed. There just weren't organizations, no matter how many people would have loved to have, for example, in Egypt, a revolutionary party or a strong civil society organization or even sort of a mass revolutionary organization that could also put pressure on the outcome after the uprising, in addition to the pressure that the Muslim Brotherhood was putting on it, in addition to the final veto power that the military had over the outcome. And I think the military really has a veto power over any final outcome. Unfortunately, I wish it weren't the case, but that's how revolutions usually go. And so what the voices, the groups that might have stepped forward and said, okay, this is what we're asking for, and this is how you can give it to us, and or, okay, we're ready to govern. Often we're just simply, we're not there. And this was, you know, to some extent because people thought that they shouldn't be there, but often to a really important extent, they had been destroyed. And so just to maybe, I don't know, cut this out if you like, or, you know, cut me off if you want. But, in the, you know, the history of protest, the history of sort of powerful citizen action emerges in the English-speaking world, but I mean really to a large extent, with the hugely inspiring civil rights movement in the 1950s and the 1960s. And so, and when I say inspiring, I don't just mean me, but I mean that like a lot of the other protest movements that happened after the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s got into politics because they were so absolutely amazed by what people had managed to do in the 50s and 60s. Those groups were very organized. Those groups were very prepared for the police to fight them, for people to lie about them. They had very tight structures that would allow for the very difficult challenges that they knew lie ahead. And then, you know, by the end of the 1960s, you had a different group, the Black Panther Party, which was, again, very intentional about being organized and having a very strong structure. But, you know, the United States government, how do they respond to a well-organized group asking for revolution in the United States? You know, the FBI and other agents of the U.S. government respond with infiltration and assassination, right? So this is one way in which U.S. history feels like what happened on a larger scale in countries like Indonesia, is that the groups that would have understood that their goal was radical change and understood that organizations were the way to do it had simply gone away. And again, there was also elements, and this comes up in the Brazilian case, because the Brazilians really did not believe in any kind of leadership. They did not believe in any kind of mediation. They did not believe in being at the front of anything at all. They would look back, I think, in some moments and say, oh, this thing that was so obvious that we could have done was blocked because we didn't believe in doing the kinds of things that the Black Panther Party would have seen as obvious to do.
Yeah, it makes me think, you know, and I think a lot of people that listen to my show know, you know, my own political convictions. So, but I don't really need to get super into that. But, you know, it makes me think of this moment. And I think I'm going back to this moment of, you know, it feels in some ways, you know, it feels, I mean, deeply horrific that we have just been watching this escalated aggression and genocide for over 6 months at this point. But at some, and also maybe I'll speak for myself, but at the same time, it also feels deeply inspiring and moving that, you know, I think after 2020, that for me was, felt really exciting in terms of the protests happening in the summer of 2020, but then quickly was, you know, very disappointing sort of chapter. And I think, you know, there's a million reasons of that, of how the sort of elite captured a lot of that momentum and redirected it, and how, you know, there's a million reasons for that. But I think there is a similar sentiment for me of just being like, wow, like going to meetings every Monday where there's hundreds of people who otherwise are not part of organization, are not organizers, might not even see themselves as activists, but are so moved by this historical moment that they want to be sort of part of history and kind of want to lend their time and their labor. But at the same time, you know, when I read your book and when I listen to you and also just kind of think of history, I'm curious, like, what are some of the things you are keeping in mind as you're observing this moment of, you know, many people out on the streets, so many people being politicized, you know, across sort of sectors of society, right? And also this happening in an election year. and, it, you know, it's, I think every 4 years you're like, this is the most important election in the U.S. But truly, you know, an election that feels maybe like no other, right? Where so many people are ready to divest from the, you know, progressive people are ready to divest from the Democrats, where, you know, Trump has a strong chance of winning again, et cetera, you know, all the sort of things you already know. But curious how you are sort of positioning, like, the knowledge that you've acquired from talking to so many people and this moment of, like, protests. And I guess maybe particularly in the U.S., which we know also has such a rich absence and wiping out of these leftist organizations, I think, in a more unique way than maybe other Global South contexts.
And certainly, I mean, if we're just talking about like explicitly left-wing like organizations, there was, and, you know, especially in the English-speaking world, there was basically nothing almost by the early 1950s. There were really like just tiny groups that popped up, but compared to even countries in Europe that had like giant left-wing parties until the end of the Cold War, still do to some extent. The U.S. like has been uniquely liberal, right? And I think there's like historical reasons for the, you know, there's the decimation of the left that happened under McCarthyism, but there's also like you know, there's the deep liberal ideology that is at the heart kind of the United States, the ideology of individualism that has been, you know, is promised especially to certain classes and demographics that, you know, you can show up here and you can just kind of have land, you can just be given, you know, it's obviously been, actually it's been taken away, but the myth is that you just get land, right? That's a really good question though about the particular moment now, and I think it's a multi-part question because I have a multi-part answer. But first I would say that protests do a lot of different things, and this is something I try to make clear in the book. It's not just only about like changing the actions of the government. It has been very common in the history of protests and totally fine that in the short term a powerful message is delivered to the state and to the rest of society, and that message is ignored, but the people are transformed in the act, and then that, you know, history is remembers what people stood up and said, and people learn new things about each other and about the country in that moment of protest, maybe come together to form different connections that allowed them to carry out different types of actions in the future. That's all normal. And that's quite a familiar story in the history of mass protest, is that a loud and powerful message is delivered to the men in power, and then they just ignore the message. But then a lot of other things happen in the act itself. So what's kind of different about my book is that, oh no, the protest gets so big that it actually is more than just a device for sending a message. It now generates an actual revolutionary situation. And things don't just go slightly differently than expected, because things always go differently than expected in politics, especially in revolutionary politics. But things actually went like way, way worse than expected. So in some ways, what I see happening since October reminds me of an older phenomenon, an older set of, an older tradition into which I think it helps to under, you know, into which we can place the pro-Palestine movement right now in order to understand it. It reminds me more of, for example, when I protested the war in Iraq in 2003 than it does of the Brazilian uprising of 2013. And I think back in 2003, a very loud and powerful message was delivered to George Bush and to Tony Blair: do not invade Iraq. And we were right, and they did it anyways. And this is, I think, true for a couple of reasons why that this, I'm jumping back 20 years instead of just 10. One is that when you have like anti-war movements, a protest is a very natural vehicle, because it is essentially taking place in the framework in the U.S. context, absolutely, of a liberal political system where you have a leader that is supposed to respond to the desires of the people. When a set of war crimes is being carried out with the active support of the current government, it's very easy to unify behind a single message: stop doing that. Without requiring huge amounts of sort of organizational capacity or like a huge decision-making process. Like in the 2010s, often everyone was invited into the streets and everyone was invited to bring whatever complaints they had about the government that they thought were relevant. And, you know, I think when you have crimes of humanity being committed daily, and you wake up to these horrors on your phone, it's pretty easy to come up with sort of quote unquote message discipline, because everyone's basically saying stop doing that. So that's when, in one way, that it reminds me of 2003 rather than the 2010s. Another way that perhaps like it seems that the protesters in this current moment have learned some of the lessons or come to the same conclusions that a lot of my interviewees in the book did. I think this was apparent to some extent in the ways that a lot of the actions have been organized. Like there are some identifiable organizations that are coordinating a lot of the actions, but I think even more importantly than that, people come ready to make one very simple demand, which is, you know, we are either U.S. citizens or Jews or Palestinians against these crimes against humanity, against this the mass murder being carried out against the Palestinians. Whereas, you know, and, you know, so, in, you know, to some extent, you know, I'm thinking of like the Jewish Voice for Peace, Jewish Voices for Peace action in Grand Central Station. Like everybody showed up with a T-shirt that said Jews for Ceasefire, which made it very hard to lie about what was going to happen. You're always going to get the media lying about you, but it made it harder. Whereas in the 2010s, that like there was a lot of emphasis on spontaneity. Well, it can't be fully spontaneous if everyone made a T-shirt, right? Like that means some level of organization and message discipline. And then there are ways in which what's happening in Palestine right now were like directly related to how the actual mass protests of the 2010s ended, like the end of what became called the Arab Spring by foreign journalists, not by Egyptians and Tunisians themselves, has a lot to do with Palestine. Like what ultimately was allowed and not allowed in the Arab world from 2010 to 2015, 2010 to 2011 to 2014, whatever years you want to include, has a lot to do with the existence of Israel and the fact that a huge majority of every Arab states, sorry, a huge majority in every Arab state is deeply opposed to the actions of Israel. And polls showed this even before October 7th. You know, polls showed this at every given point in the last few years. Yet, to survive, to exist in the regional geopolitical structures created by the Cold War, in which the United States decided to support both Israel and Saudi Arabia in different ways in order to counter the influence of the powerful and inspiring the powerfully inspiring, because the problem is that it was powerfully inspiring, example of Arab socialism led in Egypt. So the fact that you have a Arab population which cannot be represented by its leaders, if those leaders want to exist within the U.S. and Saudi-led power structure of the Middle East, has a lot to do with what happened in 2011 to 2013 in places like Egypt in the first place. So, like, this is something that was forgotten very quickly in the uprising in Cairo in 2011, but a lot of the people that came together that put together that mass uprising in Egypt had been organizing, had come to know each other through a decade or more of pro-Palestine action. And yet when they created this giant explosion, the media, people like me, people like Anderson Cooper, CNN showed up and acted like they were asking to support the United States. What they saw as a fundamentally anti-imperialist movement, what they saw as a movement for a democracy that would by necessity challenge Washington's partners in the region, so that is Israel and Saudi Arabia, was represented to the world as if it were some kind of, you know, demand to become junior partners of the U.S.-led order. And so all of this, I think, wouldn't be happening without the end of the Arab Spring going the way it did, without the Sisi coup that, you know, puts a final sort of heavy lid on, you know, the stew is kind of still bubbling underneath that lid, but puts a final heavy lid on the revolution or the revolutionary upswing in the largest Arab country in 2013. And it's also important to understand, it's also helpful to understand just why the Palestinian question is so important, not only just for the human beings that are suffering and dying right now, but for the entire region, for the entire world. Like, you kind of can't really have democracy until that contradiction is resolved, that you can't really have democracy in the Arab world if, in order to lead, you must ignore the demands of your people to oppose what Israel is doing. So there's a lot of ways that the ways that I spent the last 4 years are making me think about in different making me reflect on what's happening now, not only in Palestine but in, you know, the in the movement that's taking place on the streets in so many countries right now.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's like when I started reading this last book, I'm trying to remember when this was, but it was, yeah, like early fall last year, which, you know, feels like years ago now. But as I was getting through your book, it was hard for me to then like not return to this moment, right? Like thinking around what happens after October 7th and what are the lessons? What can we learn from, especially us in the West, right? Or people of consciousness in the West that, you know, want to be part of a progressive wave, but, you know, don't want to necessarily make the same mistakes or don't want to just, you know, or would not be satisfied with just more repression on the other end of this. And I guess that's just like how history, you know, manifests itself. I don't know if when you were writing this, you could have predicted this particular moment, but it was, you know, in the pipeline. And something I'm also thinking around is like the role of media. I think you mentioned the role of media a lot, right? Because it's, I mean, so important. And I think also your sort of POV as a journalist coming from the West also. And I think now, especially in this moment, but really, really in the past decade, in terms of how we use social media to sort of like manufacture consent and yeah, how it's become a really powerful sort of propaganda arm, not just for like the forces of the right, but really also like for grassroots movements and also even for, you know, I think it's really wild to think how many Americans are now thinking that, you know, are shifting their own perspectives based on what they're seeing on social media from the ground, from Gaza. So, yeah, curious, like, where your head is at in terms of also the distinctive role that media plays. You know, you talk about it in the book and also how you're thinking of it in this moment, right? It's so much of this is unfolding on social media. And, you know, I think even in the last week with what's happened with the Iranian embassy and the sort of response from Iran and how people are making sense of this mostly on social media or different media outlets rather than like in organizational, you know, spaces, really just. So yeah, where's your head at around media and all of this?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, we all do live in hyper mediatized. We do live in a hyper mediatized society, whether we like it or not. And like, it's almost to the point where everything that happens kind of happens on social media more. I mean, even the very traditional and like serious journalism outlets that would insist very loudly this is not what they do, they're really thinking about social media, right? Like they're really what they're really thinking about is like, how are people going to talk about this, or how are we going to reach people on their timelines, and like everything is like hyper mediated, right? And this has become so natural for us that I think that people, you know, choose what they're going to wear in the morning based on the way that it might get refracted on the internet. I think that Israel chooses what to bomb partially based on how it's going to be refracted on the internet, that, you know, on Israeli social media, on global social media. Iran, to some extent, chooses how to react because of their like deep knowledge, their like precognition of what may or may not happen on social media after they take any given action. And that's just like, that is like a deep and fundamental part of our lives. I think that there is an illusion, though. And this is an illusion that was just discussed in this other book that I like had just did a panel about. The illusion that because everything feels so immediate on social media, that you think that there isn't like a system or an organization involved there. Because actually, the production of your timeline requires the extraction of labor and resources from all around the world. There's actually a very, very big company that makes a lot of money, that has very deep very deep pockets and very powerful incentives to decide what you do and do not see. Like, it might feel like everything is coming straight at you without any kind of mediation being carried out by an organization, but there's really a lot that's just being hidden from you, and often what is being hidden is quite pernicious. And in the book, indeed, like you said earlier, like, you know, I'm end up being kind of a character in this book. Like, I wish that I weren't. But the reason I thought that I had to be is because the role of media mattered so much for the ways that protests were either hijacked or misinterpreted or had their meaning changed. And like, you know, I talked about the Egypt example. That's one. In Brazil, another one is that after the police crackdown came in Brazil, and the police crackdown was often a big part of what got people on the streets in the first place. Because as I said, like, we all live in a system where a cop will beat you up if you do the wrong thing. And that's a horrible thing to see. And we all saw a lot of it in the 2010s. And that's what gets people mad enough to get out and do something often, is to watch like another human being or, you know, someone else from their society having their body destroyed. And then having that image just like in your pocket. And so the thing that happened in Brazil is that when the media came and said, actually, this is a good thing, this protest that's happening, whereas earlier they were saying it was a bad thing, they kind of supplied their own reasons for why it would be a good thing. And those reasons were more conservative than the reasons that were given by the original leftists and anarchists. And because of the people on watching TV at home that were more conservative and then liked this message, the actual form of the street protest changed. It wasn't just like, you know, you would have had with civil rights actions in the 50s and 60s where media were going to lie about them, but the thing that was happening, the actual thing in the restaurants or in the buses or on the bridges, that wasn't changed by media representation. Whereas in the case of Brazil or even Egypt, people came to the thing because of what they saw on social media or in traditional media, and that changed the shape of the thing itself. So mediation is like so deep into this, like there's no way to think yourself out of it, even if it can feel like you're outside of it. You are so deep inside of it that I think it's best to recognize the way that all of that media, the role that media has and the power that it has for good and for evil, and how to sort of work with it, to sort of play judo with it. Because it was interesting to read, like, the people that put together the first really big protests in the U.S. in the 50s and 60s, it's interesting to watch them not even think about media at all. Like, they didn't even, like, in some cases, they weren't even thinking about the possibility that being in the newspaper would help their cause. Like, it was just like, no, we're organizing people directly. Whereas we, like, you know, my generation, you know, we learned this, like, in the MySpace, you know, at least my generation, like, learned this in the MySpace years, as I said, started to change the way we act, like, on a daily basis, based on the understanding that someone might take a picture of us and put it on the internet. Whereas this is a pretty new thing for humanity. I think it is it's a strange one that warps reality. But for better or worse, we have to deal with this process and get the best, get what is good out of it and try to kill what is bad.
Yeah, no, it's exactly that. I mean, I think it's like impossible to try to negate media out of the equation. And there's some instances to your point where I'm like, yeah, I don't know that I'd have access to this information or this perspective or this sort of, yeah, like this analysis if it wasn't for like independent journalists or, you know, particular media. And in that way, it's really helpful and sort of like instructive on just like how to make meaning of moments, right? At least for me, I'm not an expert in like history or like know all the context of every region of the world, and I think most people don't. So there's like that element of it. And then on the flip side, you know, we've seen so many organizations, you know, I've seen organizations like Palestinian organizations in New York City just have their entire account just completely deleted by Meta, and we've seen the shadow banning, and I think you know more about this, but I'm sure that that's impacting how organizers are thinking of their own tactics in protest, and also just even beyond the actual like event of gathering people out in the streets, but like everything else that's connected to that, like knowing that okay, you're going to be shadow banned, knowing that you're operating within media that is, you know, in many ways sort of like inherently neo-fascist in its own ways and its algorithm and all those things. But yeah, it's really particular times, and I feel like we're always saying this, you know, I'm 29, so some of the things, like where you start the book, I was in high school and I wasn't super like politicized yet. I think like 2012 was like my year of deep politicization, for different contexts, but then also seeing a bunch of things on Tumblr of just like people saying, you know, people with signs saying that like Obama bombs Syria. I had no idea where Syria was when I was, you know, a high schooler, and but that sort of like domino effect. So it was really powerful to kind of learn or kind of like situate myself back in like learning about these different uprisings and sort of revolutionary moments that happened when I was a little younger. But I think, you know, there's so much we can talk about, and I can ask you a million questions. But I like to ask, you know, we're talking about pretty heavy things, and I love a good sober analysis of our conditions and what has happened, what has gotten us here, to sort of try to orient ourselves as to like where we may be headed. And I think for some people that there's a lot of maybe pessimism is that in that, you know, we haven't, to one of the points you make in the book, you know, we haven't, like, the revolution we've dreamed of hasn't arrived yet, right? And we haven't materialized it yet. But I wonder, like, for you, having, you know, all these sort of threads of different historical contexts, and also just in this moment, like, what is keeping you excited?
Yeah. I mean, everyone always says this when you get a question like this, but it is a really good quote from Gramsci, you know, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, right? Like, be really, really tough on yourself when you're thinking about what you should do, but allow yourself to dream about everything that you could achieve, you know, like, and I think that, well, there's like the really big answer and there's the small answer. I think that the small answer I think that I could start with is that I think I already discussed this contradiction like twice, so it must be on my mind. That contradiction is at the center of what's going on right now in the Arab world. That, and I think in the, you know, this is a fundamental contradiction in the world system. The people of the Arab world want Israel to change, to stop acting the way that it is. And you can't have democracy in that region if that is suppressed. I think it's going to be very difficult to suppress it forever. I'm reading a lot of history of the 20th century, like what happened when more and more and more of South Africa's neighbors took increasingly strong positions on apartheid, how it ultimately became untenable to hold together that system in the face of a neighborhood that's against you. So like, if I'm thinking about like, where is, you know, what is the contradiction at the heart of the system right now that I think is a place to keep paying attention to, if you are somebody that pays attention to revolutionary energy, I think it's that. It's still kind of like Egypt and the countries surrounding Palestine. But then in a larger sense, like, it's still also true that life is quite horrible under a lot of the regimes that took power in the wake of the Arab Spring. It's true that in the United States, I mean, I'm older than you, not huge amounts, but like enough to remember a lot of elections. And like, this is by far, like, I've never had an election where there was like nothing to be excited about. Like, every election in my lifetime at least had something that was like, at least there was a new guy, you know, like, yeah, at least, you know, you back in the 90s, you had sort of like a conservative and a neoliberal, but at least the Democratic Party was giving us a younger neoliberal. Like, this election in the U.S. is like, I don't know maybe when the last time the United States had an election, which is so uninspiring. And that's like, it's a real sort of problem for a society which is relatively young and is supposed to be dynamic and is supposed to be leading the world, that it's just the same two really old guys from 4 years ago. Like, that it's giving, like, it's really like, reminds me of like late Soviet Union vibes, like, you know, like the just like a class of really, really, really old people that are just like concerned with, you know, this was what it was for a while, you know, fighting amongst themselves rather than what was going on. So even in the face of all of the really difficult realities that we face as like a population, a global population, I'm like really inspired by the ways that the people in my book responded to me at the end of our interview process, because even though a lot of these people had like their lives are destroyed, their friends killed, their friends imprisoned, their countries invaded, their homes ripped to shreds, almost nobody that I spoke to in the book gave up. Like, they still believed in the importance of learning from what had happened, regrouping, finding a new group, finding new human beings with which they could work, finding a new way to organize their friends and families and fellow citizens to try to make the world as good as it can be. Because like, what else, like, what else are we supposed to do in this life, right? Like, no matter how hard it is, or no matter how long and steep the climb may be, like, what else are we supposed to do? And I still find that is one of the best ways to live with other human beings on this planet, is to try to do everything we can to improve life for them. So, like, if the people in my book didn't give up, and the people in my book thought, no, this is only the beginning, like, who am I, like, how am I going to be discouraged by my, like, the much, 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 much less challenging conditions that, like, a journalist from the United States faces.
Yeah, I think that's the perfect note to end on. I feel like, yeah, I hear you just saying, like, despair is not an option, and millions of people all over the world have, like, remind us of that and have demonstrated that. So yeah, I think it's a good reminder for us, especially of us, like, in the West, to, yeah, keep insisting. And yeah, I just want to say thank you so much. I love both books. I am really hopeful that people read it if they haven't, read them if they haven't. And yeah, there's just, like, so much, yeah, there's so many lessons there, and then they feel kind of, like, more relevant than ever. So thank you for talking with me. Thanks for writing the books. Thanks for taking the time to outline all this complex history and, like, I don't know, a couple hundred pages.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad we can finally do this, and I really appreciate it. Like, I tried to put a lot in there in a small amount of paper. So I'm really always just, like, really grateful when people come to it with their own perspectives and their own expectations, because I find that people find different things in it, and I'm just very honored to be in this position where people are reading or caring about this work that I've been able to do with these interviewees around the world. So thank you so much again.